from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, tomorrow the San Francisco Giants hold their 52nd home opener against the Atlanta Braves at AT&T Park. The Giants have been in San Francisco over five decades, having come here from New York in a franchise move back in 1957. But Giants history goes back over 125 years to its New York predecessor teams from 1883. In this Forum Hour, we want to have a look back at Giants history and also assess how the season ahead looks for the orange and black home team and see what we can find out about the other baseball home team, the Oakland A's, and their possible move to San Jose. We'll be joined by a panel and we'll take your calls, emails, and online comments. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. The Giants have won five world championships, though all five were when they were part of the New York franchise, not the present home team, San Francisco Giants of Candlestick, Pac Bell, and AT&T Stadium playing. But the San Francisco Giants open their 52nd home opener tomorrow against the Atlanta Braves, and where baseball is concerned, hope springs, if not eternal, then certainly in the spring when baseball season begins. And Giants fans are hopeful that this could be their year with a great starting pitching rotation, a strong bullpen, and what looks like definitely better hitting. The Giants franchise goes back, however, to New York in the late 19th century. It has produced more Hall of Fame ballplayers than any major league franchise. In this Forum Hour, we look back at Giants history from the days of John McGraw and Christy Mathewson, and we also take stock of the season ahead. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour. In studio, Larry Baer, who is president of the San Francisco Giants. And good morning, Larry Baer.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. Dan Faust, author, freelance journalist, former tech and media writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, and author of a new book, Giants Past and Present. Welcome to the program.
You.
And Eric Solomon, professor emeritus of English at San Francisco State, baseball historian, in fact, teacher many years of the history and literature of baseball. And welcome, Eric Solomon.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you all for being here. And Larry Baer, I was looking at a blog thinking, what kind of questions would I ask Larry Baer about the Giants? And one of the questions, of course, is about the Athletics, because whenever you're on, people say, what about equal time for the Athletics? But I looked at a blog, and guess what the most frequently asked question was?
About the Oakland A's or about
the Giants? No, about the Giants. This is a Giants blog. In third place was Pablo Sandoval's weight, which somebody said was, might as well ask what color the Loch Ness Monster's eyes are. But the first most asked question was whether Tim Lincecum had a girlfriend. So we won't necessarily have to.
This is not a bad thing, Michael. In fact, the interest in Tim as a young heartthrob is that's never something that a team president or an organization shies away from. It's wonderful. We've actually produced wigs this year that we'll be offering at the ballpark. That people can don their Tim Lincecum wigs and be at the ballpark rooting for him. We have no shame.
They have wigs. They have bubblehead giveaways, too. They even got DiMaggio in the bubblehead giveaway this year.
You know, it's funny about you mentioned about Pablo Sandoval's weight. Seriously. You know, there was articles about Camp Panda in the off season. We were trying to have Pablo slim down a little, do that perhaps through nutrition. Although he played, you know, at a fairly heavy weight last season and hit 330 for the season, we had a tremendous year. We have the opposite issue with Tim. Is we're trying to put a little bit of weight on him. He was actually in the mid 150s. Believe it or not, when he was throwing 98 miles an hour through the heat of the summer.
Isn't cannabis supposed to make you hungrier or something like that?
so we're at sort of the opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, bulk up your pitcher and slim down your third baseman.
Well, I want to ask you about the season, and then, like I say, we're going to get into Giants history. But for all those A's fans out there, just not necessarily to get you to talk about the A's, but the San Jose Giants' territorial rights have to be resolved, and you need 75% owner agreement. Anyway, let me ask you your position now in terms of, the possibility of the A's going to San Jose.
Well, our position, Michael, has been really what the commissioner's position has been for – this is not a new issue for really – over a decade where there's been any discussion about San Jose as a possible new home. The Giants took over the franchise, this ownership group did, in early 1993. The territorial rights were secured by the Giants in 1990, reaffirmed in 94 in the year 2000. We built our ballpark went forward with the financing in 1996, relying on many representations, including the fact that we had territorial rights in the South Bay. You know, a tremendous number of our fans come from San Mateo and Santa Clara County, and it's really a kind of a fundamental part of what we believe is our grant. And so it's, you know, you say there's a vote, there would have to be, you know, it would have to be brought to the ownership of baseball for there to be a vote, and we'll see if that happens.
That's up to the Major League committee now, in other words.
Yes, the committee,
MLB
and then
committee,
the commissioner. Yeah. But, you know, we've obviously stated our case. We believe, by the way, that the A's need a new ballpark. We believe this is going to be a two-team market, you know, for as long as into the foreseeable future. So this is not, you know, some effort to try to make this a one-team market. This is going to be a two-team market. All of our forecasts and projections assume that it will be a two-team market. So we believe that there can be sites in the A's territory, which is all the East Bay. Much of the East Bay is growing, and Contra Costa County, Alameda County, and then, you know, in the greater areas of the East Bay leading out into Sacramento area, where, you know, presumably there should be a way to create a new ballpark for the A's. You know, teams have been pronounced to be, you know, quote-unquote dead in terms of their stadium issues, including 1992, the San Francisco Giants. And the Giants were reborn. Seattle Mariners came very close, you know, because they needed to replace the King Dome. They were reborn. So we believe the A's can and should be reborn in that in a ballpark in their territory, and that would be great for baseball.
And we should just say for the record that San Jose voters want the team there, but they also want the funding to come from the A's, not from tax dollars. So how things look this season, Larry Bear? Everybody's hoping that, well, even if it's second to the Dodgers, we'll get a wild card shot again, but maybe even not second to the Dodgers.
We're not shooting for second to the Dodgers, Michael, as I'm sure you know. I was in Houston and obviously off to a good start. I think if you kind of step back,
great start, actually.
Yeah, great start. When you step back, you say, okay, last year we won 88 games, just inched out of a playoff spot. We won 88 games with outstanding pitching, and the hitting, the offense, was actually second lowest in all of baseball in terms of the major metrics, batting averages and on-base percentages, et cetera.
Fifth lowest scoring runs.
And fifth lowest in scoring runs. Yeah. So I think the approach has been keep the pitching stable, which is not an easy task and not a given. But if you keep the pitching where it was last year and then improve the hitting, you know, there were not that many impact, you know, hitters that you could go out and get without having to trade one of your star pitchers. But we were able to sign Mark DeRosa. We were able to sign Aubrey Huff. We were able to secure Freddie Sanchez now for the whole season, although he's on the disabled list. He should be ready about May 1st. And we think those three hitters will add depth. It's not as flashy as, you know, the fans all wanted, you know, Matt Holliday or Jason Bay. But we think those three hitters are professional hitters. And if we can get the run production up some, keep the defense strong and keep the pitching strong, we think that 88 games could be improved upon. And if it gets improved upon, if you get into the 90s, you have a pretty good chance in terms of wins, a pretty good chance of going to the playoffs.
Well, we'll hear certainly from our listeners and Giants fans. And first, let's hear from the old prognosticator, Eric Solomon, who every year tells us about the Giants' chances.
Well, I thought that was a really elegant summary. But there are two elements, and they've always been the same two elements. You've got to stay healthy, which is really hard these days, and because there are so many pills they can give you and so many they can't. But you've also got to have the good seasons out of your players. And you add that to the mix, they should do rather well. The sad thing was reading the New York Times prognostications on Sunday. They were way down at the bottom because they were talking a lot about the strength of the division, which they're good teams. There are good teams there. But, you know, baseball is so wonderful. Three in zip. I remember when I was a kid, you loved that. They're going to win all their games. They're going to be 162
and
it's like batting 1,000, right? It's like coming up and hitting three for three.
I love the guy, you know, the guy who hits two home runs on opening day. Okay, so he's on a pace to hit, what, 364 home runs or something like that for the season. I think what Eric says is right on the mark. I mean, staying healthy is, you know, when people ask me how's the team going to do, I say, well, I don't know, the way I get paid to worry, and, you know, we're one rotator cuff blowout from disaster. So you got to stay healthy, and you're right. I mean, good seasons, you cannot assume a good season. I mean, Pablo Sandoval in his first major league season hit .330. You can't assume that's what he'll do in his second complete season.
Well, I said we were going to talk about baseball history, too, and the history of the Giants. And one of the things I learned from Dan Faust's book, and we'll talk with him as well, Eric Salmons, more Hall of Famers on this Giants franchise than any other team in Major League Baseball. And not only that, but probably the biggest long-going feud between the Dodgers and the Giants. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, not the most vicious feud between the teams. I think it was between the managers often. I mean, they did not get along.
Oh, I think the players even now kind of come up with a sense of that you hate the Dodgers. You know you're not supposed. These are not your friends, and they're not. Even though there have been times throughout history, whether it's Jeff Kent going to the Dodgers or.
Oh, you're right about Freddie Fitzsimmons. That was like one of the blackest days, so
right.
to speak.
Giants pitcher in the 40s, and when he got traded to the Dodgers, he thought it was over. How could I can't be a Dodger. I hate the Dodgers. So, and yet the Giants turned around and brought in Leo Durocher as their manager, who had been deriding the Giants. When he made his famous quote about nice guys finish last, he was talking about the Giants.
But, you know, we were also talking about Jules Tigel before we went on the air. Jackie Robinson was traded to the Giants, too, although it didn't go through.
And didn't. Well, he didn't. He agreed not to report.
Yeah.
Which fueled the rivalry.
And a lot of people attributed that to the rivalry, although it was interesting. At the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, they have a copy of a letter that Jackie sent to Horace Stoneham, the Giants owner, saying essentially, I'm retiring from baseball. I've already decided to retire from baseball. The letter was written on chock full of nuts stationery. He was going to work for at the time was a big company in New York, the Starbucks of its day. And he wished Horace Stoneham all the best, and there was no animosity or any inkling that it was had anything to do with the rivalry.
Well, you know, the other thing you learn from your book is how Peter McGowan, and it's been said on this program that Larry Bear had a great deal to do, maybe even the lion's share with keeping the franchise here, but certainly Peter McGowan did as well. And the fact of the matter is that as a New York boy, he went through all that mourning of seeing the Giants franchise move. He wanted to keep the team here, in great part because of his own personal experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was a kid when Bobby Thompson hit that home run in '51, and he was crushed when the team left New York. Although his family came out to San Francisco around the same time, and so I think Peter not only did a lot to keep the Giants in San Francisco, but he also did a lot to then tie that history back in and bring that New York history back to the fore.
I love Peter's story. He tells it so eloquently where literally his father came out to run Safeway in 1958.
The year after.
You feel like they kind of took the same plane. And I'll never forget also when Peter was 13 years old, he tells a story. He came home from school and his father went with a number of businessmen to a game in 1951, and came home, and father came home, and the other businessmen had left the game early, I think the seventh inning, and the father said, his father, Robert McGowan, said, son, I stayed to the end, Bobby Thompson hit the home run, and that'll teach you in life, never give up.
Now, as long as we're talking about Bobby Thompson's, as it was known, shot heard around the world, and Eric Salmon, literary folk, we know just the attention has been paid to that, most recently Don DeLillo, I suppose, in Underworld. Now there's been talk about telescopes and buzzer systems. Well, what do we know about that home run being legitimate?
Everything's
entirely
legitimate. Baseball, among other aspects, is a game of cheating and trickery and faking, whether it's a pickoff play or whether it's kicking the ball out of the shortstop's glove, using a spitball, what have you. They do that. And it's absolutely irrelevant. Stealing signs is a basic part of the game. Just one point about what we were saying before. There's never been in the literature of memoir of sport any impact as strongly as the Dodgers leaving Brooklyn. Anybody who was interested, and all the kids were in baseball at that time, pinpoints that moment of betrayal. And Walter O'Malley was certainly worse than Hitler in their minds.
Well, and it's interesting because there's a new book. There's a book out last year that essentially said O'Malley was not the devil that he was portrayed to be, and it was actually Robert Moses, the power broker mm-hmm. of New York at the time, who kind of forced O'Malley's hand and refused to give him the new ballpark in Brooklyn. And I'm also kind of I've always been intrigued at how the Dodgers have been so romanticized, and I think, you know, through Roger Kahn and these other writers who've been able to build up this nostalgia for the Dodgers. And it was just as crushing for Giants fans in New York mm-hmm. that the Giants left town. But somehow that's been almost forgotten. There's a New York Baseball Giants Nostalgia Society that meets in a church basement and gets about 40 people every couple of months up in Riverside.
But talk about nostalgia for the Giants or the nostalgia over the Giants leaving. I'm looking at a picture in your book, Dan Faust, and again, he's the author of Giants Past and Present. Wonderful book. Pictures are great. Picture here of John McGraw with that kind of tough look on his face back in 1910. And Roger Angel said, and here it is in your book, that the Giants hold the undisputed championship for hard luck, for losing ball games and pennants and championships and bitter, hair-tearing, unimaginable misadventures. Wrote that in 1958 before they never played a game in San Francisco.
Right, where they took that, you know, with all due respect to Larry, I mean, they've taken that heartbreak to an art form, I think.
Well, Eric Solomon grew up with the Red Sox, remember, too.
You don't know a heartbreak. But one point, you know, the Giants are one of the few teams, let's see if I can construct this sentence properly, about whom a detective story was written and set in the World Series. I think it was, were they in a World Series in the 30s? They were.
Yeah, we were in three of them.
Yeah. And Ellery Queen, who was a detective, a fictional detective, is at the game. Someone is killed in the stands. And it's a short story, a really long short story. And you have the game in the background, JoJo Moore hitting something and one thing or another. And he's solving, Ellery Queen is solving the mystery during that of who killed. Hmm. And it's all done and wrapped up.
Well, I'd like to put Ellery Queen on the case of why the Giants haven't won the World Series in San Francisco. I think, you know, it's another one where Boston and Chicago, you know, kind of wear it on their sleeves. And I don't know, you know, we've thought a lot about this is maybe it's because, you know, that when they lose and the season's over, then they have to settle into those horrible winters, whereas in San Francisco, we then just go out to go sailing or mountain biking or something. But the Giants you know, we can start talking about the 62 World Series or the 2002 World Series and
all. Boy, you write about the 2002 World Series as if the pain is being shed on the page.
It hurts me just to bring it up.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Larry Bear.
Dan mentions, you know, the Boston and Chicago. Actually, sort of, you know, you get mixed feelings here if you're with the Giants when the Red Sox win and then the Chicago White Sox win. Because if you can now make the list of established clubs, we're not talking about, you know, Tampa or whomever, but of the established clubs, you know, we're right behind now the Cubs and the Cleveland Indians in terms of not having won for the World Series for the longest. Now, we've been in the World Series several times in San Francisco. So I think in some ways that there's that pent-up feeling like existed in Boston before the Red Sox won it. A few years ago, and that makes for an interesting dynamic. There's you know tremendous fervor and tremendous interest and tremendous you know sort of tension around the fact that let's in our lifetime in the next few years you know accomplish that the Red Sox and now the White Sox have accomplished.
But there's no it may be a rivalry here for the most tragic sense of a franchise, but probably the Cubs have to eclipse everyone. I read in Larry Stone's baseball trivia book where he said there was a guy who was buried across from Wrigley Field, and on his tombstone it said in Yiddish, "The Cubs stink." He wanted to be buried with that on his tombstone, Eric Solomon.
But your problem is that both the Cubs and the Red Sox had a quasi-religious myth. the curse of the Bambino because they sold Babe Ruth, like in slavery, down the river, sold them to the Yankees for money, for sin, Harry Frazee's showgirls, and the Cubs had some goat or something, right?
The Billy Goat.
The Billy Goat. But the Giants got to get one.
The Giants had their own religious fervor. In fact, Dan writes about Alvin Dark in the book. I mean, he had a lot of that religious fervor.
Right. Yeah, one of the other stories that was fun that I had never heard before, but Daryl Spencer, who was one of the original Giants in 58, talked about an effort to steal signs in the 59 pennant race where Herman Franks, who was one of the guys operating the telescope in 51, had come back and offered to Bill Rigney, the manager, to steal signs, and the players were all for it. But then Al Worthington had seen Billy Graham at the Cow Palace and had pronounced himself born again, and he said, if you guys do that, I'm walking off the team. And they knew they couldn't do that. And Spencer said the morale fell out, and they wound up finishing third behind the Dodgers and the Braves.
We're talking about the Giants, past and present, and of course we're going to invite you, our listeners, to join into this. But I was just getting a sense of how we measure baseball past and present. And of course, as Larry Bear and Eric Solomon, who've been on with us before, well know that sometimes salaries certainly come up. And you read Dan Foss' book, and by the way, did you ever decide whether the Zito contract or the Aaron Rowland contract was more painful? No, there's this whole sense of salaries just measured by the fact that Willie Mays was making $105,000 back in 1963, the highest rate salary. And then the reserve clause came about in 1975 as being eliminated. 1993, Willie Mays' godson, Barry Bonds, signed a six-year contract for $43.75 million. In 2002, five-year contract for $90 million. I mean, there's the gap right there, and it's extraordinary.
Well, it's not extraordinary in the last several years when you read about the money that is being paid to the Wall Street mega giant managers who have destroyed much of our financial system. These guys at least play ball.
And they don't get raises necessarily as they're fumbling and as they're making errors and missing and striking out and so forth.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, it's you think about Willie and you think about how he ultimately was traded to the Mets because that his salary, his six-figure, he had inched into six-figure salary territory back when the trade was made in 1972. And Horace Stoneham could not afford that or said he could not afford that. So now you have to think also, though, to be fair, we talk about salaries and a lot of hand-wringing over salaries. I remember I briefly after college worked in baseball, and the gold standard in the early 80s in terms of attendance, 1 million fans. If you could get to 1 million fans, you were a successful franchise in the late 70s, early 80s. Now, we need to be at 3 million to be anywhere near break even. 3 million fans. Three times.
Fans, money, but the other big index I was thinking, of course, is color. I mean, you read Dan Foss' book and you see all that Latino infield, and you see black outfield, and you see the farm teams bringing up more and more people from different countries, Japanese players and so forth. I mean, it really has become a global game.
Yeah, and it's great to see. I mean, that was baseball's great shame in the first half of the 20th century, the color line. And so it's been great, and I think the Giants have been great about promoting their Latin America. You know, they were one of the first teams to hire a lot of Latin players, and they've had black managers, and they've done very well.
Coming up on a break, I want to get our listeners involved in this, baseball memories of the Giants. What do you think of the season ahead? We can talk about salaries, color, whatever's on your mind. Join us, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, any questions or comments are welcome. It's toll-free to join us at 866-733-6786 or send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about the San Francisco Giants. Once the New York Giants, now the San Francisco Giants, gearing up for the home opener, which is tomorrow against the Atlanta Braves. And looking back at the team's history, getting a season preview, all of that, with Larry Bear, the president of the San Francisco Giants, here with us in studio, along with Dan Foss, author of a new book called Giants Past and Present, and Eric Solomon, professor emeritus of English at San Francisco State and baseball historian. And you are welcome to join the program if you have some memories about the Giants or questions or comments or maybe even some perspective about what kind of a summer game is going to be this year. We welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can simply post a comment on our website by visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. And Larry Bear just told a very funny story off air about Bud Selig and Gaylord Perry, and it's worth hearing again.
Well, I was just saying that, you know, all the allegations through the years and everything kind of just, you know, over time sort of melts away. And Gaylord Perry, all the you know, accusations about spitballs and this and that. But he's in the Hall of Fame, and he's in the Hall of Fame, and he's much revered for his career. And it was really quite a career when you look at it, all the years and the number of outings and the number of innings he pitched. And so we were all there with the Hall of Famers. Bud Selig happened to be at the ballpark.
The commissioner.
In spring training a few weeks ago. And, you know, Gaylord walks in and everybody's Mays, McCovey, you know, everybody's there hugging each other. And Gaylord walks in and they're all hugging each other. And it's sort of like, you know, okay, whatever happened or didn't happen. It's interesting. I mean, you know, Eric talked about the way the game gets played. And there's everybody's always looking for an angle.
Well, I remember the great pitcher, Preacher Rowe, who may have been one of the most – am I right, Eric? Probably one of the most chronic spitball throwers of all time.
He holds the record.
He was lionized long
weighing,
after he
weighing left. Less and throwing harder, yes.
Yes, weighing less and throwing harder. By the way, the Giants have, for you Giants fans, I think this should be quite a festive event, the 10-year ballpark anniversary on April 11th. Jeff Kent and Barry Bonds expected both to be there.
Yes, they are. They're both coming. And it's when you think about it, you know, again, it's so generational baseball. And even, you know, like our children who were very young when the ballpark opened in year 2000 now have memories of, they may not have memories of Willie Mays and Willie McCovey as players, but they do remember Barry Bonds, Jeff Kent, JT Snow, Rich Aurelia, Rob Nen, Kirk Reeder. And those names are becoming, you know, names that for a lot of fans were, you know, define baseball as they were growing up. So it's, can you believe it's been 10 years since they took the field, April 11th, year 2000?
Well, and I'm excited to see Barry coming back. And, you know, this is the first time he's come up yet on this show. And we were talking about cheaters, and a lot of people look at Barry and the steroid scandal and view him as a cheater. But I for me, as a fan, you can't take back the feeling of that you had watching him play, and it was just fantastic. It felt like it must have been to watch Babe Ruth play. I mean, they were so afraid to pitch to him. He never saw a strike. He still would lead the league in hitting and home runs. And so I, for one, look forward to the day when the Giants put that statue of Barry Bonds outside the ballpark.
I like your enthusiasm, especially in light of the fact that you admit in your book you didn't like him.
He's completely, as a, you know, as a human being or as a person, and I think a lot of fans had trouble connecting to him on that level, and as a, you know, getting to come into the clubhouse a little bit as a reporter working on the book at the end of the 07 season, you could see him refusing to talk to the reporters and just what an antagonistic feeling it was, and all that other, all the trappings of his own little corner of the locker room and the special treatment and the better than thou attitude. I found him almost repulsive as a person, but as a fan and as somebody, you know, just to watch an athlete, you know, which is what I go to the ballpark to do, and to see these guys perform, he was terrific, and it didn't bother me at all to cheer for the guy, and he was our guy, right, Larry?
Sure. I mean, the thing about it is, and what you want is, and this is all coming up now with the Tiger Woods issue, but what you want is a player, or, you know, somebody in the creative world. I think you can't just say it's about players. I mean, it's actors, it's musicians. You want them to be wonderful people, and you want them to be able to communicate to their audiences when they're not performing in ways that would be, you know, like a role model, like a school teacher, like a parent would.
You want an icon to be an icon.
Exactly. The reality is, and you shoot for that, and you want it, and we'd like, and when we look for players to trade or draft, we look for character. But the reality is, in these industries, music, acting, entertainment, sports, you don't always get it. And as Dan says, so you have to appreciate the art and work as hard as you can for the player or the performer to do it as best as he can when he's in a different, you know, in a different setting, and it doesn't always work.
Eric Solomon.
Yeah, but the special quality that Barry Bonds brought, and I've only seen one other ball player who had this, Ted Williams, you could tell when Bonds was at the plate when he was going to hit a home run. You just, if they didn't walk him, that he would hit a home run. That was the magic, and that's what his special quality was. And you're right, the other stuff does not count, because when you are a really great actor, all the other stuff goes away.
I mean, Jack Nicholson, I don't know. Do you want to spend have your children spend a weekend with Jack Nicholson? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I'll say one thing about Barry Bonds.
Tell my daughters. Yeah.
I'll say one thing about Barry Bonds. He loved, and I don't use that, you know, I don't use that casually, that word. He loved the San Francisco Giants. He wanted to be a Giant when we traded for him. His father was a Giant. His godfather, Willie Mays, was a Giant. And he loved, you talk about the history of the Giants, and he, wearing number 25 for the San Francisco Giants, and when we first heard about the possibility of us signing him as a free agent, he broke down. He grew up with it. He was 3 years old in the Giants clubhouse, you know, running around, playing with his father and Willie Mays. And it meant a lot to him.
You can almost say the history of the Giants was in his DNA, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and I think the fans connected with him. It was almost like, and when he got into trouble, you know, the fans supported him because, you know, if somebody in your family gets into trouble, you don't throw them in the garbage can. You do what you can to try to get them back. And that's why I think, you know, no matter what people said or you know, how their attitudes around the country were toward him in San Francisco was different, because I think he was felt like a member of the family.
Let me, before I go to your phone calls, go to some emails here, because we're getting, as you might imagine, I put the idea out that listeners could send us some memories, and getting some great things here. Listener Michael in San Francisco says, my dad is 88 years old and has been a Giants fan since he was 13. That was in 1934. When he went to a home game at Wrigley Field in Chicago and saw the New York Giants beat the Cubs on a Mel Ott home run. Last summer, my dad came to San Francisco for the first time in his life for a visit. We took him to a game at AT&T Park where he saw Edgar Renteria hit a Grand Slam home run to bring the Giants from behind for a sweep of the Colorado Rockies. Watching my dad's face was thrilling, and it showed me what he might have experienced as a 13-year-old boy many years ago. And that's a pretty eloquent statement about how baseball can go with you through a lifetime. There's another listener who says, for me, there have been three wrenching moments. Bobby Thompson's home run. I remember crying and hoping that maybe his foot was outside the batter's box and that the home run would be disallowed. The Dodgers moved to L.A., and the Baltimore Colts moved to Indianapolis, especially after the last one. I've been a passionate fan of any sport. Stephen writes, many, many years ago in the early 1960s, that's many, many years ago in the early 60s, okay, we would travel from Siskiyou County to Walnut Creek to visit my grandparents for a week. And after getting the morning's work done and having had lunch, Granddad and I would sit in the living room and listen to the Giants game on the radio. Willie Mays and Jesus Alou are the players' names I remember best. The greatest impression on me as a seven-year-old was the timbre of the voice of Lon Simmons. Mm-hmm. And Lee from Palo Alto says, sports like pro baseball are only profitable for teams and leagues through taxpayer subsidies. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston described how the works in his book, Free Lunch, how this works in Free Lunch, how the wealthiest Americans enrich themselves at government expense and stick you with the bill. Johnston shows how complicit government officials to help the leagues and teams skirt the law, how pro sports stadiums create economic dead zones around them, and how taxpayer dollars are diverted from parks and libraries into the pockets of billionaire team owners. Our laws even allow leagues to exclude teams owned by the cities themselves. Now, Eric Solomon, you've heard some of these arguments. In fact, we had David K. Johnston on that book. Get some response from you?
Well, the connection between the city and the ball club is always a sore point. We hear people weeping about the Brooklyn Dodgers or the New York Giants. What about me? What about the Boston Braves? They went away. Evil man named Lou Perini. He was a contractor. Did the city mean anything? No. Did whatever money was made from the Braves, which is very little.
They went to Milwaukee first, by the
way. Yeah, they did. I think it's you pay for what you get, and what a ball club gives to a city, and this is a soft one for you, Larry, is in large part an identity.
You know, and I won't say this was all altruistic. I mean, we did it because it was the only way for it to happen, but we were proud to do it. We built the ballpark privately. So, you know, we're not playing in a municipally financed ballpark. We're playing in a Giants Finance ballpark. And, you know, and we're proud to have done that. That's not the case everywhere. We said that, you know, and there are many markets, smaller markets, that couldn't do it, didn't have the corporate base, didn't have the season ticket base. But, you know, but it feels good to actually be, you know, we wear San Francisco across our chest and we represent San Francisco. But we're in a ballpark that was built privately. And I think that will be, by and large, the way ballparks do get built. And you see in California, to bring it to the present time, you know, there's really a crisis in terms of teams that believe they need new facilities, football, basketball, baseball. And will they get them from public finance?
You're also in one of the most beautiful ballparks.
That's one of the challenges for the A's, I think, is because how can the A's ask Oakland, which has so many challenges and schools and crime and other challenges, and while there's many great things about Oakland, I mean, how can that city or that county justify spending money on a ballpark?
Eric, you want to say something quickly here?
Just that the moment when the city and the ball club came together was the earthquake.
Yeah.
I was in the stands that day, and somehow we felt that they were part of us.
Yeah.
Well, you got a portrait in Dan Faust's book of Marjorie Wallace, Ballpark Marge. I mean, sort of the archetypical and most loyal fan. Reminds me of the woman who used to sit in all those Jack Parr shows, you know, Mrs. Miller. Let me go to our callers, though. We got lots of them, and we begin, Joe, with you. Good morning.
Is it me?
If you're Joe.
Oh, yeah. I lived on Staten Island, New York, and I was a Giant fan. After Bobby Thompson hit the home run, I went up to his house, knocked on a door, and his mother came out. And I said, "Is Bobby home?" And she's Bobby, and he came out. And I had a brand-new baseball that I bought, and I asked him if he would sign it. He didn't ask for money. He asked my name. He signed it. I took it home, and I made a stand for it over the fireplace. Went away to college, came home, and I said to my mother, "Where's my ball?" And she said, "I gave it to the kids next door." And I see they're selling for about $1,300 now, but I never would have sold it anyway.
Yeah, but what a story. I mean, what a different era that was. You just go to his house and get a ball signed.
He didn't ask for money. He didn't tell me to go away. And
my mother threw away my baseball card collection. So, I mean, we all have those stories as well. Thank you for the call, Joe. Let me get more callers on from Dublin. Mark, hi.
Hi, Michael. Great topic. You know, I don't think one needs to find any mythological reasons for the Giants' futility since they've moved to Los Angeles. For instance, you mentioned Gaylord Perry earlier.
They moved to where?
To San Francisco.
Boy, talk about your Freudian slips.
Oh, God, no, I was going to invoke the Dodgers as perhaps a better business model for how they've functioned. But to get back to the Gaylord Perry example, the Giants traded Gaylord Perry for Sudden Sam McDowell, and, you know, Perry goes on to be a Hall of Famer, and McDowell has a bad arm, and this is one in a numerous number of examples of, you know, Bill Madlock for Ed Whitson, and Ken Reitz for Lynn McLaughlin, and Orlando Cepeda for Ray Sadecki. I mean, the Giants were cursed with, let's say, not as good a front office as their hated rivals were, and so in spite of the fact that, you know, and of course, you know, it looked like things might be turning around when we got local ownership with Bob Lurie, but who does he get to be his general manager? Speck Richardson, the guy who built the Cincinnati Reds into a powerhouse while he was the general manager of the Houston Astros. So, you know, I mean, it's just one thing after another. And fortunately, the Sabian era has, you know, begun to turn things around.
Well, you fans have a long memory, but one of the things that's turned things around has been this farm system. I mean, it's really come up and been paying a lot of attention to it, I know.
And homegrown, I think, is sort of the way to go. It's interesting. You know, you talk about all those trades. I think you're going to see fewer and fewer trades because what teams are doing is they're trying to lock up their players, their homegrown players, expensive as it might be, through their free agent years. We just did one of those a couple weeks ago. Matt Cain, we were able to sign into his free agent years. So, you know, I think you'll see fewer and fewer of those trades because really where it really pays off these days is to be able to, raise players through their through your farm system and then have them emerge and be on your team and then be on your team for a while. I mean, one of the great problems in sports right now is player movement team to team, and you lose the identity of that team. And, you know, one of the things with Barry Bonds, you talk about him, he was a Giant for 15 years. That doesn't happen that much anymore.
And Mo joins us next. Mo, welcome.
Just basking in the glow. April has not been usually a kind month for the Giants, especially in the last couple of seasons.
Well, the poet said it's the cruelest month, remember?
I know you get this question asked a lot, Larry, about the big bat, and I'm just wondering, it seems like the Giants have a real good balance right now, and whether you think the big bat would help the Giants go any further than I think they're destined to go this season, probably 92 to 95 wins.
Well, Mo, if we get to 92 to 95 wins, we should be in the playoffs, which, you know, you'd like to win 100 or 105 or whatever, but if you can get into the playoffs, I think history shows that it's somewhat of a crapshoot in the sense that, I mean, the St. Louis Cardinals won 83 games a few years ago and won the World Series. So if we can get there, and I think there's a long way to getting to 92 to 95 wins, I think that, you know, you get to the playoffs. In terms of the big bat, you know, the reality was there, you know, unless we were to pay, you know, what turned out to be close to $20 million for Holiday or Bay in the offseason, any of those big bats that you talk about would have required the trading of a pitcher. So are you net better off if you go out and trade for somebody else's big bat and lose one of your big arms? As we said earlier, we did win 88 games with very strong pitching last year. So what we tried to do was move to bats that we think are very professional bats and will help us significantly, like Mark DeRosa, Aubrey Huff, and Freddie Sanchez.
Well, here's an ancillary question, if I may, Larry, from Chuck, who says, I'm wondering, with all the big contracts being committed to the pitching staff, which has ballooned the payroll to the point where the Giants have surpassed the Dodgers, will there be enough money for position players that will score enough runs and provide enough defensive support for the young fine young pitching staff? Don't get me wrong. I love Lynsium, Kane, Wilson, Zito, and Sanchez. DeRosa and Huff are good hitters, but are a temporary fix. What's the future for the Giant lineup outside of Posey? I don't see a lot of young hitting talent in the minors. Is the strategy to plug lineup holes with aging hitters obtained through free agency?
No. You will see names, and these are names that just aren't household names because they haven't been publicized much, but you will see people like guys like Kieschnick, Gillespie, Neal, will join people like Posey. You haven't heard the names. There's a kid named Ford who actually tagged up and scored from second base on a fly ball to center field in the minor leagues last year. A lightning fast kid. So we actually think behind the curtain, I mean, it's a good question because these guys haven't really been well known, but behind the curtain are probably the best crop of position players we've had in decades here. And they're probably about 2 years away.
Again, Larry Bear is president of San Francisco Giants. Eric Solomon.
There's just one tricky aspect of all of this. Unless you have at least, you have to have three very good starting pitchers to get through the playoffs.
Yeah. And the loss of Randy Johnson is a big loss, really, isn't it?
Well, he added a lot last year.
Yeah.
But as Eric says, if you get three strong starting pitchers, we think we have four, maybe five, and we think Jonathan Sanchez, who is starting tomorrow opening day home opener, is ready to emerge. And so I think is the foundation of a team these days.
We haven't heard from Dan Fust, a super fan, on his notion of the prospects for the Giants this season. What do you think?
Oh, I've got that spring optimism. I'm loving it. I think that when Larry was talking about trades, I think that the trade people forget about is that Brian Sabian did not pull the trigger on a Tim Lincecum or Matt Cain for Alex Rios of the Blue Jays. I mean, what a disaster that would have been. So I think when people are out there taking their pot shots, you got to remember that it's they've done a good job of just staying calm, and I think I think that with a lineup of these fairly professional hitters, I think there's a potential to. I mean, they got 19 hits yesterday. Obviously, it's early in the season, but that's more than they got in any game last year. And Renteria, I was not a fan of that signing. I liked a lot of these younger players they were bringing up, but if that guy is a proven major league hitter, and maybe he had the surgery he needed, and he can start hitting again. As Freddie Sanchez comes back again, former batting champ, I think that, like Larry said, they've got the pitching that can take them deep into the playoffs.
You never know where hitting's going to come. I was at a game when Lincecum was pitching and saw him get a hit. And here's an email that I can't resist from Michael in San Rafael, who says, I have a book that has this little story in it. When Alvin Dark took over the manager's job, he watched Gaylord Perry taking batting practice and pronounced, "A man will walk on the moon before that guy ever hits a home run." Fast forward a number of years to July 20th, 1969, Alvin Dark turned out to be right, because 44 minutes after Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, Gaylord Perry hit his first home run, helped the Giants win over the Dodgers.
True.
Mike.
Eric Solomon.
Well, you know, baseball is all of what we've been talking about. It's also the numbers. It is the statistics, and that is what people love. We have gone too far. I just wanted to share one thing, one factoid from the Morning Chronicle, very briefly. The Yankees yesterday set a record for the modern era with their 17th straight win in regular season games that were tied after seven innings. And that record had been held by the New York Giants, 19-6-16.
There goes another Giants record.
I love it. If there was ever a sport
we got made... Don Nelson now, by the way, too. Let's not forget.
If there was ever a sport made for the internet, it's baseball. Yeah. Because when you think about all of the statistics and all of the comparisons and all the vast depth of information, it's baseball and the historical and the generational nature of it. So in some ways, baseball really clicks in. My children showed me how to follow the Giants game. We went to the first two games in Houston, then had to fly back as the third game was being played. How to follow the Giants game play by play, pitch by pitch, highlight by highlight, you know, on your little handheld. It's unbelievable that just sort of the richness of the information and how you can access it now, real time, or go back and compare it to past generations.
And still now you can watch them all on the iPad, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I still prefer they come to the ballpark. Larry would, I'm sure.
Oh absolutely.
Yeah. Let me go to more calls here. Dan, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Yes, hello. I have a few comments just about the general fitness of baseball and the player salaries. I generally don't have a problem with a large player salaries relative to the revenue the game generates. I think they're a major reason for all the revenue. And I think it's a little different from how a lot of businesses in the country operate, where the big money goes only to the executives. And you sometimes have key contributors who just work on salary and don't make those big numbers. So I think it's a little interesting difference between baseball and other businesses, and I just wanted to comment on that and see what you all had to say.
There's a deafening silence here in response.
I think it's a good point. I mean, look, we sort of peg it, and I think the industry sort of pegs it, that about 50% of revenue goes to player salaries. And that's, if you can do that, the teams can have a decent financial model and the players will be well compensated.
There's a listener who says, the word mercenary. He says, I've been a baseball fan for more than 50 years. Barry Bonds was probably the greatest hitter I ever saw. It was a thrill to watch him at bat. But he's no member of my family. He was a mercenary, just like all the other professional athletes today. I don't blame them for that. They'd be foolish to turn their backs at the money that is put in front of them. But Bonds was more than a mercenary. He was also sullen, self-absorbed. He also stands indicted for federal crimes. Sure, he was a great player, but let's not get overly sentimental about him. Tough stuff.
Oh, people create heroes, and they create anti-heroes, and that is what a spectator sport, alas, is about, and one just shrugs and moves on.
Well, let's move on to another caller, and that's you, Robert. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to talk about Jeff Kent and the attitude that was put forward to him. Before I say something, I would also like to say that, remember, Bonds was walked all those times during the steroid period, but I just don't understand how we and why we treated Kent towards the end of his career here. And if I could have 30 seconds, my favorite Kent story is I went to a ball game with my ex-girlfriend, her first game. It was the seventh inning. She got up to go to the bathroom. I said, where are you going? She said, I got to go to the bathroom. I said, are you kidding? She said, why? I said, because Marvin Bernard's going to coming up. He's going to pop up or strike out. Aurelius is going to hit a double. Kent's going to hit a home run. And the Giants are going to win by one. And right now in a nothing-nothing game with Russ Ortiz pitching. She left. Some guy turned around and gave me a dirty look. I said, what do you want? I said, third time up at bat. Sure enough, Bernard popped up. Aurelius hit a double. Kent hit a home run. And they won by one.
So you're a soothsayer.
Well, it was pretty clear. And like I said, I don't understand with Kent being probably one of the most prolific second basemen. He didn't possibly have the defense of Bobby Thompson, but overall, he's going to go in the Hall of Fame, no question. And he was definitely a key part of the Giants that period. And I think that also described a lot of attitude. She looked at me and said, Bond's not coming up. Why should I stick around?
But where is she now?
Girlfriend.
I think you're right, though. Jeff is probably going to go to the Hall of Fame, and I think the attitude changed. Look, when a player leaves, it's difficult. It never comes out quite right if a player goes to a different team. And Jeff, you know, went to a different team. You saw last year we honored him, and he was very gracious. And I think the fans are sort of the rapprochement has happened.
He's coming back April 11th, as we said earlier. And let's get you on, Mike. Good morning.
Mike, and I wanted to make a comment about what a privilege it was to see the three M's on the field at the same time, Mays, McCovey, and Marichal. It was just an absolute wonderful time to go out there and see them on the ball field.
Well said, and thank you for that memory. And, well, the season's ahead of us. Let's hope for the best for the Giants and the A's, both the home teams.
Root for the home team.
There you go. Yeah.
And one of the great things, I think, on Friday and all the days is just walking in the upper deck and watching the mothers and sons and fathers and daughters having an experience.
Well, I thank you all for this preview as well as this look back historically. It was a lot of fun and enjoyed only a lot of fun, but enlightening. Enjoy the hour we spent together. Dan Foss, again, has a book out. Great pictures in this book. Again, I have to commend what you put together here, just well with the prose as well as the photographs. It's called Giants Past and Present, and I'm not hyping him. I really like the book a lot. He's an author, a freelance journalist, and former tech and media writer for The Chronicle. Eric Solomon is professor emeritus of English at San Francisco State University, where he has taught for many years a course in the history and literature of baseball. And Larry Bear is the president of the San Francisco Giants. Gentlemen, thank you again for being with us on this hour of Forum. And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour's repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I'll be back with you on Monday. We're going to meet Benjamin Bratt, who, along with his brother, made a new movie. And we're also going to talk to some poets on Monday, including Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz. I want to remind you that our senior editor is Dan Zoll, our producers are Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, and Erica Kelly, and our interns. Thank you to our interns, Jeremy Blackman, David Carini, Julia Jackson, Alexander Park, and Mithya Srinivasan. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.